first of all, I'll go around and greet everybody. We did, somebody has called in, and that's all we see is call in user. So call in user, if you wanted to unmute yourself and tell us your first name and where you are, that'd be cool. Hello?
Hi, Delmio. My power shut off for a bit, or my phone. So, yeah, I think that was just me.
It's Ruth Ann. All righty. I am renaming you, so we know who you are.
Oh.
Okay, cool. Usually we see your phone number, Ruth Ann, but for some reason it didn't show up. So right. I'll say hi to
Ruth Ann. It was just the power.
All right. Hello, Ruth Ann. And Peter? Jeff, Young, Tyler, Paul, Ken, Isaac, Marv, Karen, Sam, Susan, Linda. Linda in Portland, there's another Linda, but she might have fallen off. What's the first letter of your last name, Linda?
R.
Okay. In the future, I can say Linda R. Mark W. Haven't seen Mark C. for a while, but just in case. Jill. Charles. Jim. Shoketsu. Joan. Mick. Kathy, Gathel, Bob K, John in Texas, Jinryu, and Drew. Did I miss anybody? Everybody moved around at one point, so I'm not sure if I missed anybody. All right. Let's see. In terms of announcements, there's a one-day retreat a week from this Saturday, so on January 23rd. And speaking of retreats, I know that I've been mentioning that I had the Brightway calendar set through the summertime, set through June at least, but I did have to shift the March retreat. I haven't done that on the calendar yet, but I need to move it from, I think, the 27th up to the weekend before that. Like, so it'd be like the 20th, I guess, then. So anyway, just in case you were somebody who was like, you already got that on your calendar, I'll apologize for that. So I will be sure to change the website calendar to reflect that. Let's see. So we have like three more classes on the Norman Fisher book after tonight. I'll have one more class on meditation and then two classes on the perfection of wisdom. And then we'll go on to a series on foundational Buddhist teachings. And those, the reading material, if you want to read or listen, will be certain of my podcast episodes, which I will, I'll refer and tell you which ones to read or listen to if you want to do additional study. That's all I can think of for now. Maybe I should mention there will be a terms student program this spring. So there's information on the website about that. We haven't put it in the newsletter yet, but we should. I can't remember when the first retreat is. It might be in February. If anybody signed up for that, you could chime in and let me know. But that's where we block off a 3-month period and we begin with a retreat and we end with a retreat. And it's really on Zoom, it's just a half day. But basically over the course of those 3 months or so, you form your own personal vows, and the cohort of people that sign up for the program do both of those retreats and do some check-ins in between and share our vows with one another. And it helps, you know, you get to know people better. And you also have a little bit of reinforcement for your intentions. So you might want to participate in that.
I think that's March 6th is the opening one.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for letting me know. So if you want to, if you're interested, then you need to look at the opening retreat and the closing retreat and make sure that at the very least you can make those. Okay. Any questions or other announcements I should remember to make? Okay. So tonight, we are continuing with our study of Norman Fisher's book, The World Could Be Otherwise, and we're moving on to the perfection of meditation. So tonight, any questions or thoughts about meditation are fair game, one of our central practices. And I thought it was interesting the way that Fisher starts off the chapter, pointing out that he says the practices of that we've already studied, the first four paramitas, perfections, the practices of generosity, ethical conduct, patience, and joyful effort exist, more or less, in any culture, in any conscious tradition of character cultivation, whether religious or not, and do not require extraordinary skill or knowledge. But the fifth and sixth perfections, meditation and understanding, are different. They involve a more mystical or spiritual frame of reference and require an effort beyond what we would commonly make in the normal course of our daily lives. Meditation is a specific technical skill. It requires instruction, discipline, and development. So I thought that was an interesting thing to point out, that these last two perfections are a little bit different than the first four. So in terms of meditation, what is meditation? He points out, same page, the word meditation is an English word from Old French and Latin, meaning to think over, to think deeply, to reflect. And as such, meditation is not new to us in the sense of folks in the West. We have a long tradition of meditation as a form of thinking. Of course, we are thinking all the time, but mostly in scattered and unconscious ways. To meditate is to think calmly, deeply, with focus and serious intention. Philosophical thought is meditative. It requires that we step back from ordinary thinking, emotion-driven planning and strategizing, to a profound consideration of what we most deeply value and understand. Meditation is also a religious word. It includes various practices Christian monastics and other Western religious practitioners have developed over the centuries. We might more commonly call these practices contemplative, quiet, directed thinking inspired by faith and a sense of wonder or surrender. Scripture reading, prayer, and sacred singing are in this sense forms of meditation. Such meditation practices are also included within the range of Buddhist meditation. But Indian meditation practice, Buddhist and pre-Buddhist, includes in addition a particular technique that our culture seems to lack. The specific practice we usually think of these days when we use the word meditation. I'm talking about the psychophysical practice of concentration, in which a meditator sits upright in a yogic posture on a meditation cushion or chair, focused on breathing, silent and aware. This powerful and simple practice is Indian culture's great gift to the world. So radically simple. Yet as far as we know, no Western person ever thought of doing such a thing. So what is meditation? Now, some of you are familiar with me citing this book, which is The Relaxation Response, which was on the lowest shelf in my office when my parrot got out. So that's why it looks the way it does. So this is by Herbert Benson, MD, published in the 70s, I believe, 75. And he did, psychologists did basic research into meditation and why certain kinds of meditation seem to have positive health effects and stuff like that. So what he found in his research was, you know, he was familiar with having studied the stress response, right? When we perceive, you know, there might be a need for fight, flight, or freezing, that hormones are released, stress hormones are released, our heart rate increases, our breathing rate increases, our blood pressure increases, metabolic rate increases, blood flows to the muscles, we're ready, like we're in a heightened state. And what he found in his research was that meditation triggered, if you will, what he called the relaxation response. So it's like we've evolved the ability to have the unstress response, right? The opposite response to the stress response. So he was curious about what, because it was big, you know, transcendental meditation was big at the time, and they were making claims about how this specific form of meditation was so beneficial. But he was like, you know, do you really have to, you know, get a mantra from a TM teacher in order to, you know, access these benefits, or what, you know, what's really going on here? So what he boiled it down to was that this had to be, this meditative activity had to be, it had to be deliberate. This wasn't something that just happened while you were sleeping or dozing or walking along. I mean, there had to be a conscious choice. And then it was just the repetition, he said, of a word, a sound, a phrase, a prayer, or even a muscular activity. At first, he thought maybe you needed to be sitting still, but he found that this response was not limited to just sitting still. So you had to just be choosing some kind of repetitive, very, you know, theoretically boring activity. And then you passively disregard everyday thoughts that inevitably come to mind and just return to this repetitive, whatever you've chosen, and not worrying about how well you're doing. So when other thoughts come to mind, you simply say, oh, well, and return to this, your repetition of whatever it is. And the key was this, you're not trying to get anything done, right? You are just letting go of your thoughts and returning to this very simple thing. And when this was done, and he found again that it didn't necessarily have to be when you were sitting still, when you were doing this, there was a decrease in stress hormones, a decrease in heart rate, decrease in breathing rate, decrease in metabolic rate. So like all of the opposite things from the stress response. So there's many meditative activities that we might do other than seated meditation. But we might not do them meditatively, really, right? Or at least not maybe all the time. So there's certain activities we might do that are relaxing, and maybe that's because they're naturally a little bit meditative, like we let go of some of the busyness. But this response in particular would be like, all right, if I'm going to garden, I am going to do my best to just, you know, whenever my mind starts to get busy about something else, I just let that go and just return to gardening or return to running or cooking or cleaning or whatever form of meditative activity we're doing. So the question, I think, for Buddhists sometimes, particularly Zen Buddhists, because there's other forms of Buddhism that don't emphasize seated meditation the way that Zen does. The question that arises for Zen folks sometimes is if you can do meditative activity in doing these other things, which might be more interesting or enjoyable than sitting, why sit? So that was going to, I figured, would be our breakout tonight, which is to, first of all, to just reflect on and share, if you will, an activity or more than one activity that you might do that you at least sometimes do meditatively, or, you know, kind of intentionally try to do meditatively. So sometimes if I ask kind of two questions, then people get confused, or they never get onto the second question, but I guess that's not the end of the world. So meditative activities, but then also the question of then why sit? What does your actual seated meditation practice do or give you? How is it different in its results or its experience from your meditative activity? Any questions before I divide us up? All right. Looks like we still have some decent breakout rooms going here. All right. Here you go. All right. We had a really cool discussion in our room. If I don't know if anybody take a couple minutes to just, if any questions came up, or if you just heard or thought of anything that ended up being kind of cool or inspiring in the conversation, please go ahead and unmute yourself and share. Nothing interesting. Kathy?
I have a question.
Yeah.
In our group, every member of our group had experiences that they describe, that they experienced as being meditative-like, that were what I've heard described as being in a flow state where you're in an activity, you're completely engaged with it, your attention is all there, you're very attuned to, you know, your moment by moment interaction with what you're working on. And I had a question. So within our group, we were using the word meditative in describing these, but I wondered if there's something a little bit different there, because in that flow state, all of those activities were examples of us working towards something that had an outcome that we were trying to achieve. So there was like this mindful presence quality, but it was different from, for example, Zazen or Kinhin, where, you know, you're stepping in Kinhin, but you're not really having an aim to go anywhere. Or with Zazen, you're have an effort and a direction and an intentionality and attention, but you don't have an outcome that you're seeking. And I wondered if that distinction is just...
That is a very good question. It makes me want to get Benson to like hook us up to machines, right? And see like, if we're in a flow state, what, you know, do we experience this kind of, you know, relaxation response? And my guess would be that it would be a Venn diagram kind of thing, right? Like the flow state would kind of overlap with a meditative activity somewhat, in that we're kind of undivided and maybe not so agitated, or, you know, there'd probably be some similarities, but there is, and I hadn't really thought about this before, actually, that importance that the, at least according to the meditation response, right, and according to all the spiritual traditions, right, that the meditative activity is not really achieving anything. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you are deliberately turning your mind towards something that is very non-achieving, non-agenda, I guess.
And that seems to make it harder.
Yeah, it does. I mean, because you're not naturally, I think Fisher even said something about this, right? Like your mind doesn't usually, it's not naturally drawn to focus on something that it isn't invested in, doesn't care about, or isn't being entertained by, right? So it's that very deliberate choice to turn our mind towards something that is so simple and unstimulating that brings about this kind of, and just for fun, I'll just share the, I'm not sure, because I wrote an idiot's guide on meditation and I covered 9 different kinds of meditation. And so I talked about Benson's book, and there's also, of course, there's no way to prove this, but they think that perhaps this relaxation response, this meditative thing, maybe Benson mentions that, I can't remember, might have evolved when human beings, when we formed communities, and we, particularly when we developed fire, and then we could gather around the fire at night and be safe. So we had these situations where we could be safe, where we could relax, and that we would be staring into the fire. And that's when this kind of, you know, we kind of learn to meditate.
Yeah.
Just, we're safe, we're staring into the fire, we don't have to worry about anything. And that, so I think that's kind of cool to think about. But
I love that. Thank you.
Any other thoughts or comments before we move on? Mick?
I think it was interesting that Kathy had said something about like not having a goal in mind, and kind of independently of that, we had a couple of runners in our group, and I know specifically Drew and I were saying that like on the meditative runs is when you're not wearing a watch, you don't have like a mileage goal, you're not trying to like hit a certain pace, you're just going to go and run. And those were the ones that like when I was running, that was where I would find that kind of like zone or whatever you want to call it. But you know, if I'm out there to run like, you know, X amount of miles and X amount of time or whatever else, like it's never going to happen that way.
And don't you think, just for fun, I'm just thinking about this, like, don't you think that people who are really, really good at some of these things, musicians, athletes, that perhaps like they're actually doing it meditatively, perhaps. Like they aren't there out there with this, like, I'm gonna, like, that actually they are really, I don't know, maybe even like they've let go of the result and it really is just this thing.
It's so interesting that you say that, because like the phrase when people are like playing really well is they're playing out of their mind. They're not even thinking about it. They're just playing, you know? It's the Dharma gate of joyful ease for them.
Yeah. Sweet.
One of the things this conversation is reminding me of is when I have engaged a very little bit in drawing and taking drawing lessons, and I am not proficient by any means. I'm very much the beginner, but I really, really want to get back to drawing in just in my daily life, not to mention my practice. Because what I learned from drawing, and this is before I even got to Bright Ways In, I was concentrating on what was really there, not what I saw. So in other words, if I was trying to draw somebody's eye, what I'm really looking at is a circle and another circle, and then all these little triangles that go around the circle and these things emanating from that circle. It's not an eye anymore. It's just what is there. And I am really eager in my own personal life to get back into studying that more to see where it would take me.
Nice. Thank you.
I am hearing, if I may say, within my breakout room and from Jinyu's comments just now, two different things. One person in our group talked about motorcycle riding, in which it was so, you had to have all of your attention on the external, almost opposite of meditation, that it was very much like meditation. You know, if there's a full circle here, he met, you know, at the opposite of that point of sitting and finds it meditative. And similarly, what I'm hearing Jinyu say is that, and I forgive me if I'm mispronouncing your name, she's with an intention as a beginner to learn and is so focused in a different way. But I'm also going to say that's external. In contrast, I have this book here, Flow, you know, and I think you were talking about when you're an expert at doing something, you don't really have to think about how to do it. I'm going to just say Keith Jarrett is an amazing pianist who can just play without really trying. You know, many people are as good, perhaps, you know, I don't want to get into who's better, but that is different. I do see that as another, and I think you brought that up, Danyu, in a moment ago. Could that be a meditation too? I don't venture to answer that, but I do see two different, the total external. I think both the motorcycle riding and this drawing of the eye are external, whereas Keith Jarrett and playing the piano, not so, you know, just sort of playing without trying.
It's very, very fascinating, which kind of brings me to that other question that I don't know if people had much of a chance to review. And but thankfully, we have another week to talk about this chapter, right? Because there's a lot that we won't even get to tonight. But what about actually sitting? So if I'm to guess, I mean, most people that I've met probably don't sit as much as they would like or think they should, and are sometimes drawn instead to, you know, meditative activities, because meditative activities can be more either more enjoyable, or, you know, maybe you're getting a little bit something done at the same time, or to some extent sometimes they're not as hard maybe as sitting. But there's other benefits to just sitting. So I don't know if anybody had any, had some cool things come up in our group.
Well, if I could just say one more thing and then I'll listen. My whole purpose in bringing up the example of my being a beginner at drawing is because I was a beginner. And yet I still felt, long before I heavily began to practice meditation, that what I was doing was meditative. And interesting about the metaphor of riding a motorcycle, I just finished reading the book Thoughts Without a Thinker by Mark Epstein, which I do recommend. I feel like I have to read it at least one more time. But one of his expressions for meditation that really was very helpful to me was bare attention, which is what the motorcyclist seems to be doing, just complete, unadulterated attention across the board. So I thought that was interesting as well.
I think one thing about activity meditation, if you want to call it that, is that we get focused on something that we're familiar with. So it's, you know, you have body memory and you go through this thing, such as for me, it's cooking, especially prep cooking. The thing is, we get in a state in which we kind of is our ideal of meditation. We're doing this activity. There are no thoughts intruding. We're very focused. And so it has similarities to meditation, and it has similarities to our ideal what meditation is, because we all, you know, one misconception is that the thoughts won't come. You're attempting and on the cushion not to have those thoughts. And, you know, Kathy said, well, on the cushion it's much harder, and that's true, because then you don't have this natural built defense against your thoughts. You're not focused. You're trying to focus on your breath and such, but, you know, that's not that easy. And so we have intrusions. So that's one difference between activity and sitting. But the other thing about sitting, though, is that those intrusions is one of the things that helps us learn. I mean, one of the purposes of meditation is to learn about ourselves. And so those intrusions oftentimes are teaching us something. If they keep occurring, if they keep showing up, they're saying, hey, you know, pay attention to me. And, you know, you may move on, but it's sort of an identifier,
yeah.
It's sort of a teacher. And that really, I think, only happens on the cushion, when you're really not doing anything else except meditating.
It's extremely hard to let go without that, outside of that simplicity. You know, if you think about sitting, the sitting that we do, just sitting upright, eyes open, is like the simplest activity we can possibly do as a human being and not fall asleep. So we're trying to simplify it. This is the simplest thing we can do. And ideally, you know, we're letting go of activity. We're letting go of physical activity, and we're letting go, at least trying not to give extra fuel to be attached to mental activity. But as I've talked about before, it just like that activity, it's possible like that to let go of activity in more and more and more subtle levels. Even when we're sitting there and we think, this is pretty calm. This is pretty cool. Not too many thoughts going on here. There's still mental activities going on there. There's still assumptions we are holding about who we are and what reality is and what's going to happen next. Now, these are bad things, right? But they are, this is the ideal, right? Is that at some point, at some moment, we let even that go. So, you know, my experience of being in, you know, meditation retreat. And, you know, it's after many days that finally the mind is settling down a little bit. It's all relative, right? So for me, it's from like crazy busy to like, you know, I notice the thoughts. I notice I can actually, oh, there's a thought. There's another one. Like I actually notice them. That's, you know, they slowed down a little bit. And like, to actually just be able to let go of, you know, who do I think I am, my assumptions about the world. It's like it's a mental structure that we're holding, you know, that we're holding on to, that only in the stillness of meditation can we that, you know, really just letting everything go. And we do need to feel, usually we need to feel safe and relatively comfortable in order to let that guard down, which I just don't think is something that we can. So that's why we do the practice of walking meditation as well, to take the simplicity of complete stillness and do a little bit of movement. And I don't know about you, but like even just the slow walking makes it a little bit more difficult. So every bit more activity makes it more challenging. So let's see. There's so much more to talk about. I guess just one of the things I wanted to invite you to think about was looking at meditation as a perfection. So, you know, so far we're talking about it as a practice that we do, which it also is, but you know, within the paramitas, it's reflected as, you know, there's generosity, ethical behavior, patience, joyful effort. And when you think about those things, you think of them as virtues, as aspects of your character that you cultivate. So I was thinking about, if you think about jhana, is the Sanskrit word for this paramita. And it means concentration. What qualities, in a sense, are we aiming to cultivate and embody? Not just we're aiming to do this practice, but what is the perfection of concentration? Perfection of and let's see, we have a few minutes left. I'll pull it up. I was gonna do a shared screen brainstorm. Where is my? Anybody have any thoughts before I pull up my my shared screen here?
Willingness to focus or practice focusing.
I was just going to say losing yourself, you know, you're concentrating, but.
Cool. All right, let's see. So losing yourself. And Ruth Ann, what was it? Willingness to
focus. I was thinking about the breath.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for me, it's like trying to observe without labeling. Like, it's incredible how quickly the mind works to say, like, that's a chair, that's a light, this is good, this is bad. And just to kind of like, just experience it without like putting all this extra stuff on it that your mind does all the time.
Calmness.
I would say, like, maybe openness as well.
Accepting whatever happens.
Attentiveness.
Patience.
see, unscattered.
Focus.
Picturing, how do you want to manifest dhyana throughout your day?
Peacefully.
Purposeful.
So, clarity occurs to me.
What about single-mindedness?
Yeah. I think that's one of the definitions.
Vibrancy.
How about equanimity?
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine concentration if you don't have equanimity. Absorption is another.
Receptivity.
All of these things make jhana or concentration seem much more interesting and warm, you know, than just, the perfection of concentration. Well, perhaps we can continue that next week. It's 9:00. I will do our closing first. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you, Domio. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone. I love the jazz hands.
Sweet dreams. Sweet dreams.
Good night.
Thank you all.